previously.tv podcast network.
Doing this under protest.
Believe me, so are we.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Beverly Hills 90210. Today's episode, season 9, episode 14, I'm Married. And now here are your hosts, Tara Ariano, Charity Bunting.
Hello, Sarah. I'm married.
Hello, Tara and Dave. I'm married, too.
Hey, before you guys start, I have a little site business. We now have a dedicated website for this very podcast. It is at againwiththis90210.com. Your feed should already be in the new place, but just in case you happen to be listening to this sometime and you're like, well, wait a sec, something's wrong, go to againwiththis90210.com and all the feed information and whatnot is there for you. And that is site business.
Also, more site business, reminding you that you can purchase an ad on this podcast. Go to previously.tv/ads for more information. $100 for a commercial message, $50 for a personal message, and we will write up something for you, read what you want. You tell us. We are here to serve. All right, now into We're Married. I mean, I'm married. We are all married.
It's true.
We're married to the show. So let's start with our C plot. Noah and Steve prank stuff interferes with David's attempts to trap some other new broad. So Steve, Kelly, David, Noah, Janet, and Donna are sitting around the Walsh coffee table playing strip poker, apparently at Noah's suggestion because he's really good. That's the theory. He's wearing these yellow sunglasses that I want to hate, but Dave Cole had sunglasses of that sort around this time, so I can't, because he was very cute in them. You remember those sunglasses, Dave?
Yellow? Still have them? Sunglasses?
Yeah. Yeah, you had they were black frames with yellow lenses.
No. Oh, yeah.
I remember that.
I do remember
sure
those.
You do.
Yeah. It was the 90s, guys. Lollapalooza was in the air.
Everyone had those.
Went well with my Charlie Bono. Brown shirt, no doubt.
Also, I guess this is based on the strip pokerness. I guess this is going to be one of the weeks where we pretend slash forget that Kelly and David are like kind of brother and sister. Sometimes they say they are, sometimes they don't. I guess sitting around looking at each other's junk, this will be an off week. Anyway, Kelly comes back to the poker game reporting that Matt wasn't in his room. We'll get to him, believe me. But it's just in time for Steve to strip all the way down. And Janet just frankly stares at his junk. We were really divided on her reaction because you had clipped this photo for the visual aids. And you said that she's acting like she's never seen it before. I thought she was just frankly staring at it like, yep, there it is. You know what I mean?
I mean, could have been. I just wanted the scene to end. Like it just went on way too long.
Mm-hmm.
And how many times will Steve's nudity be mined for comedy? I ask you. Don't answer that. We're all going to have to find out together.
Yeah, he's a lot naked in the next episode as well, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
For health reasons. But anyway, moving on. We'll get to that, too, next week. The next day, Noah and Steve banter over breakfast about Steve's poker loss. But when Noah leaves, Steve puts on these glasses that Noah was wearing the night before and tells Donna they go with the marked cards that Noah was playing with, reminding Donna that Noah had her down to her G-string, gets her to join Steve in his revenge plot. Meanwhile, David is having breakfast at the Peach Pit, where else, and expositing about upcoming health inspections when he hears a woman behind him crying and goes over to see what's up. Now, I don't want to be rude to this woman, but she is not a good actor.
No.
I don't want to say she's not cute, but she's not cute in the way that, like, gang love interests usually are. Like, she kind of looks like a younger Yardley Smith. Sorry?
Yeah.
She's got weird teeth. Like, she's got to be someone's niece. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. The hair is not ideal.
Yeah. Anyway. Also, her story doesn't go anywhere. So there's like all. Anyway, we'll get to the nowhere it gets. But anyway, it turns out she's crying because she's reading a galley of a sad book. She's a development executive. But David can't put all his moves on her because then Steve and Donna show up to enlist him in their plotting. he goes along with them. So their plan to get back at Noah is messing with a soda tank behind the bar at the club. But when they all post up at the bar that night to watch Noah deal with the sabotage, nothing is happening because the tank that was already hooked up is still full, but then it empties and they make Noah spray water, seltzer all over himself, and Tori Spelling's fake belly laugh must be heard, clip two.
Got him.
So creepy.
God, it's bad. And then the facial expressions that go with it are very stuffy.
Yes, of course I gift this. You can see this in the visual aids too. I don't know if that laugh is better or worse than the heeing. They're both really, really annoying.
Yeah. And her nails continue to be weird Streisand-y. So like that's happening. Like her weird Prince of Tides manicure is happening, even though she's trying to be all Lucille Ball, like busting a gut. It's very bizarre. I'm starting to feel active pity for everyone who is stuck in these non-plots all the time. Yeah. And like there's still like 500 episodes to go in the series.
I know.
Oh, why? Yeah.
So they let it be known that this is about Noah's cheating at strip poker, and he comments that he should have thrown out his glasses. True. His retaliation is to put green dye in Steve's shampoo, so for the rest of the episode, he's walking around looking like Jared Leto in Suicide Squad. So then Nat and David are once again discussing the health inspections when the D girl comes in with apparently the same script, which she's like 15 pages into, but David goes over to talk to her and finds out her name is Carol. He brings up Cinema Paradiso, which she also loves. It's playing tonight in Santa Monica. She'd love to go, and they're firming things up when green-haired Steve passes behind David with a covered cage. That squeaks. So, next door, Noah's stalking through the club, stressing about the health inspection, while Donna and her fucking crazy hair follow. Now, you clipped one picture of this, and I turned it into a triptych, which you can see in the visual aids. Probably will be the lead pick on this post. Go ahead and tell us, try to describe what's happening with her hair, this pigtail situation.
I mean, it's like it's like Chrissy Snow pigtails, but then there's also a ponytail in the back, and then everything is crossing over at the top.
Yeah.
It's like someone tried to make do like a hair show Star Trek Enterprise on her head and then abandoned it halfway through and didn't spray it.
Yeah. Yes. It is.
Yeah.
The weirdest thing about all of these incredibly overdone hairstyles, like, I know it's the 90s, it was a thing, but like, there's no way you can look at these girls and think they did this themselves with their two hands. Like,
yeah.
It would require you to believe that they have a hairstylist coming to their house every morning at the beach apartment and like doing this to them.
I just don't. And even when they're supposed to have like a functional updo that's just like in a claw clip because they're going running, which we'll get to it in the next episode. But like they always have the bangs down in their faces to the extent that like there is no living human who would go running like this.
No, no, not
or
at all.
Or would go anywhere like this because it's annoying. It gets in your face and gets tangled in your full makeup that you're also going running in.
It's so much that like even when they just look kind of normal, like they don't look like they're locked in time and they're styling, it's such a relief. Like there's one shot of Kelly that you clipped where like her hair looks normal, her makeup looks normal, she's in like a white V-neck t-shirt, she's making a piss face because it's Kelly, but other than that it's just like, oh, she looks like a person. It's like such giving my eye a safe place to land. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, we are on the brink of like she has very low flow shower head shit happening in the next couple of episodes, because I think they're trying to transition her into that choppy lob with the super chunky lowlights, which she actually looked good at. Like, it's a dated look, but it suited her pretty well, I thought. But this transition is roof. Plus, I think Jenny Garth was pregnant again at this time. And
apparently not. Someone did the research and said,
oh, okay,
we're between pregnancies.
All right. So then they're just making her look like shit for fun, which there's no other explanation.
Well, it goes with her shitty character. So back to the story. Does. Donna promises Noah it's all going to be fine. Then Hal from the health inspector's office shows up. Meanwhile, Steve and his green hair loose a rat from the cage. And then Hal finds a trap, of which Noah denies knowledge, though at the very least it calls him to question the thoroughness of his preparatory cleaning if he didn't notice it himself because it's like out on the dance floor. But that's when the rat scurries up to Hal and Steve comes in to gloat because, LOL, Hal isn't really the health inspector. He's an actor Steve hired. Noah is impressed, but then Hal starts gasping and holding his heart and keels over and Noah claims there's no pulse. And Steve says he hadn't told Hal about the rat because he wanted him to look surprised. Stupid panicking from all of them ensues. So then they have to hide the body from the real health inspector and decide they're going to put him in the spare fridge that the Peach Pit for some reason has. So first of all, why?
Just a cabinet. Like, it's not even a...
Right. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
So the real inspection goes fine. Which is a relief because the paramedics are on their way. So I'm not sure why they called paramedics because they put Hal in a fridge. Meaning if he wasn't dead before, he's definitely suffocated now.
Yeah.
But when they come into the kitchen, the fridge he was in is gone because the salvage guys just left with it. And the EMTs come in looking for Hal and they all have to cover stupidly. And Donna does some end of scene mugging and it's terrible. So over to the salvage yard. The guy running it is the guy that Brenda spilled soup on when she was Lavoine. I went back to the visual aids for that post, but we did not take a shot of him then. But trust me, it's him. He greets them all at the salvage yard where they're all talking about the end of a man's life, which they caused as if it's like a huge inconvenience to them and not, you know, a dead person. Like, I get what they're trying to do with the storyline and like, spoiler alert, it's all fake. But... like a guy died. They're not the tone of all of this is completely wrong. Like they're just playing it like it's the slapstick Three Stooges stuff. Like, no, a guy died as far as you know.
Yeah. It's not you sideswiped his car and took the mirror off.
Right.
He's dead. Also, what happened to the rat? Like someone right. call the rat's agent and get some cheese and find the rat. Poor little guy.
So they tell the soup guy they're looking for the Peach Pit fridge, but it's just been crushed. So they end up back at the Peach Pit after dark, laying out the complete absurdity of their situation and the bad writing it rests on in clip 3.
He had a wife, 2 kids.
We have to talk to her.
And tell her what? That we had a rat scare her husband to death, and then we tossed him inside a refrigerator, and then we had that crushed into a cube? I don't think so.
Well, I know she'll be upset.
Upset? But... upset? She's gonna have us thrown in jail.
Yeah, you should. Just you committed dicks.
You committed crimes. That's what should happen to you.
Ugh.
How dumb are you? Oh, my God. So then Steve makes a prison rape joke, which I will not dignify by clipping it. And it's Cinema Paradiso. David is apparently being stood up by Carol, who also gave him a fake number. Do you want to talk about the scene where he tries to call it on the clunker in his pocket?
Something that I always regret not writing down. So I have now written it down and I'm going to keep track. We all know that 555 or KL5 is the, you know, it's a fake exchange. It doesn't exist.
Right.
But I do feel like 0143 is consistently the number that's used.
Ooh, interesting.
Like that it's almost always that combination. And there must be, I don't know why. They do that and there must be some reason and I'm going to do some research on it and get back to you guys in a couple weeks, but
okay. Interesting.
I'm pretty sure it's always some, it's like 0134, 0143. Like I feel like the gang's numbers are all that, like probably Brandon's number was that at some point. I will report back. These are the little non-interesting non-factoids that we have to cling to get through this sea of stuff.
Yeah, it's true. So he waits outside the theater through the previews and then they won't even give him a refund, which is bullshit. Usually get the first half hour at least to request a refund at the movies. This is my consumer message to you.
It's David. I'm fine with it.
Fair enough. The next day, Donna and Steve and Steve's disrespectful green hair go to Hal's widow's house to give her the bad news instead of, I don't know, talking to Matt the lawyer first. She hasn't seen Hal since yesterday. Is he okay? They put on their saddest faces to tell her the story, and she starts to cry and then also clutches her heart and hits the bricks, and Donna and Steve just run away like 10-year-olds. Like, yeah. They run back to their car and leave the door wide open with this maybe dead woman, maybe not, in the doorway. So David is in the booth that night when Carol shows up. He disbelieves her story about her mother's car accident. When he shows her the fake number she gave him, she tells him he wrote it down wrong. And her mother's not doing well. Carol is on her way to Chicago to look after her for a while and gives him the galley she's been reading and kisses him on the cheek. Seriously, who cares? Then Steve and Donna are also at the club and they feel so bad they got all dressed up to go out drinking. And they see that Mrs. Hal is there and go over to tell her how sorry they are for her loss. And of course, this was all Noah's prank. Hal is alive. Donna's reaction face. This is one of those instances where I had to note that she looks nice. Her hair is normal. It's like a regular kind of French twisty updo.
Uh-huh.
Her makeup is understated considering it's nighttime. She's got a smoky eye, but it looks good. And like she's at a club. It's appropriate. She just looks she's barely mugging through the scene and looks really pretty. So good job, whoever styled her for this one scene. You can see it in the visual aids. Apparently, this all
We're
comes
so
down to
desperate, you guys.
I know.
So desperate.
It's true. This all apparently comes down to shared landline stuff because Hal called Steve and got Noah instead, blah, blah. Then there's one more seltzer spray for Noah. The end of this dumb storyline. Wow, what a waste of time.
Yeah. Listeners, if you know for a fact that Carol and also Carol, really? Phyllis?
Yeah.
Is that the
Carol
bell?
Is my mother's name. She was born in the 1950s. So.
It's like Barb, my mom, who graffitoed Brandon's car.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Not a thing anymore. If you know for a fact that she won a contest, let us know. Because I feel like she must have won a contest, or quote, won a contest. Second prize is two episodes of Beverly Hills 90210.
Yeah. Or if you are Carol, hit us up. Sorry, we said you weren't cute enough to be an actor.
Seriously. Actually, how'd law school turn out? I hope great.
Okay, moving on to our B plot. Dylan's recovery takes him back to Luke Perry's roots. So the sun is barely up as a guy in a hard hat by the beach addresses his community service crew, including Dylan, with a positive message that will get the best work out of them and encourage them in their efforts to improve their lives. JK clip 4.
Rule number one, you are dirtbags, drug users, con men, thieves who cut a deal and got community service instead of hard time.
Not a rule.
Gypsies, tramps.
Oh, I mean, first of all, it's rude, but more importantly, that's not a rule. It's a subjective assessment.
I mean, I was on this guy's side. I was really considering clipping his braying of "Shut up, McKay."
Yeah,
but then he turned out to be a racist shitbag. So, mm-hmm. Oh well.
So rule number two is they do what he says. Rule number three is that if they don't do what he says, they lose their deal and go to prison, which is, again, less a separate rule than a subset of rule number two, which is itself rule number one, because rule number one was not a rule. Also, this is a hey, it's that guy named Christopher Murray, who was Nick Newport Sr. on Parks and Recreation. So if you look familiar, that may be why. Turns out their assignment is to build a fence. Dylan tries to commiserate about the boss with a fellow crew guy whose name we will eventually learn is Ramon, but Ramon just wants to do his 80 hours and move on. So Dylan starts shoveling rocks at the bottom of a pretty sheer cliff, which is when Ramon says that if Dylan keeps it up, he's going to cause a rock slide. And he tries to tell the boss that they need to shore up the wall with netting before they proceed, but the boss isn't trying to hear it from a dirtbag. Dylan defends Ramon, and we can't even enjoy the boss telling Dylan to shut up because he calls Ramon by two wrong Latinx names and also threatens to have him deported. So same page based on my notes. And he leaves Dylan and Ramon.
Not
just
great
go
that
ahead.
They're shoring up a wall either, frankly,
no,
in today's political climate.
Yes, it's not a border wall, but yes, I hear what you're saying. So he leaves. Dylan and Ramon just go ahead and resume shoveling. So enjoy that rock slide, Malibu. That night at the Peach Pit after dark, Dylan resists Gina's attempts to get him to bitch about his shift. She doesn't want to have to beg him to open up. Well, he just wants to get through it. He gives her credit for helping him and asks her for the space to do this his own way. And that's when a woman who is not white, believe it or not, she's an African-American, comes over to the table and hugs Dylan. This is like the 15th black woman on the show. So congratulations, everybody. This is his NA sponsor, Linda. Again, I shouldn't say that. We have a friend,
also,
Linda, who's our age. But
at least in AA, opposite sex sponsors are no go. So
I only know that from television. I think I learned that from ER, actually.
Yeah.
Gina's immediately on her guard. I feel like job one for Linda is to advise Dylan not to hang out in bars, but she checks to make sure this isn't a bad time. Gina says it's not and excuses herself. Time to learn more about Ramon, guys. He works two jobs. He's going to night school to get his contractor's license. He was arrested for falling asleep at the wheel after his night shift and hitting a parked car. And then it's lunch, but there's no break from the boss being specifically racist and generally shitty as he is when he sees Ramon reading and takes the book out of his hand. Clip five.
You gotta be kidding. I hate to break it to you, Jose, but you don't need a contractor's license to build adobe huts.
His name isn't Jose, it's Ramon.
Is anybody talking to you? Maybe you didn't hear me.
No, I heard you pretty good.
Look, let it go, Dylan. Just let it go, bro. And I had you down as one of the good ones.
Yeah, well, you were wrong.
Can't argue with that.
No, you can't.
He's also eating an apple like a total hard ass.
Uh-huh.
He's like, chomp. Like, oh, okay. Look at the way the man eats a stone fruit. Look out.
But Jesus. We've all seen TV before. He should have like an unnecessary knife and be cutting it into pieces for no good reason except to have a knife in his hand. Like that's usually the trope. Anyway, Gina then meets up with David to make him talk her off the ledge about Dylan and Linda. Gina rudely says she hopes Linda falls off the wagon because she's jealous of Dylan seeking help from anyone who isn't herself. Not helpful, not supportive, not a good addict partner, I'm going to say. At the job site, Ramon can't believe he and Dylan basically got the same sentence when Dylan home invaded a couple at gunpoint, which he's not wrong. That's a great point, Ramon.
No, he's not.
So Ramon was also right about the rock slide, and sure enough, a huge boulder comes loose and rolls into a truck. And
Speaking of Star Trek. I was like, I'm surprised they painted it back from purple. It just came bounding down.
Well, I give this
side full of the joy of life. It was funny.
Anyway, let's hear the aftershocks, as it were, in clip six.
Damn it! Didn't I tell you to shore up that hill?
No, you didn't. He did.
Yes, sir. You did. It was our mistake, man.
Wait a minute. This guy almost died over
but
there.
But he didn't, did he? All right, everybody, excitement's over. Get back to work.
You owe him an apology.
I said get back to work.
I said apologize.
You're gonna pay for this, pal.
In that case... Oh, Dylan! Man, what are you doing? Bro, you just got our sentences extended.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Oh, you want me to thank you for costing me a shot at my licensing exam?
Look, that guy was wrong, Ramon.
Dylan, I told you, bro. 80 hours in and out. I got goals, man. Just because you don't doesn't mean you can mess with mine.
Just a note that I see where Dylan is coming from, but there are ways to use one's privilege when you're in a position like Dylan to help somebody that is less advantaged than you, and that's not the way.
Yeah. Picking a fight on his behalf like you're both 12 is not it.
No. So Dylan comes home, still all dirty and gross, to find Gina in his room lighting a shitload of candles, and she intensely tells him it's important that he know he doesn't have to talk about anything. She's just going to take his clothes off, put him in the tub, and put him to bed. And he's like, that's it? And she says if he's too tired to do anything else, she understands, but then there's more kissing, and he thinks he can muster the strength. And they've just fucked when the phone rings. It's Linda, and he kicks Gina out to talk to her. Gina. She can't believe it, tells him to go to hell. Maybe you need Al-Anon, just a thought. The next morning, the mean boss exposits that punching him got Dylan more community service hours, which, you know, that's it.
Never saw again, P.S.
No, indeed. But Dylan wants to take full responsibility and make sure nothing happens to Ramon. The boss is unimpressed by Ramon's hardscrabble backstory, and somehow Dylan ending it by saying Ramon is better than either of them doesn't help. Again, Dylan, think before you talk. You are bad at this. So after work, he walks on the beach, finds a pretty shell, and is about to throw it in the ocean when Ramon appears and stops him. Apparently, Ramon is not getting any more hours, so Dylan's intervention might have been helpful, and saintly Ramon urges Dylan not to give up on himself. So Dylan goes to the beach apartment to talk to Gina, who starts the conversation strong by slapping him in the face. But she does eventually let him talk. He gives her the shell, which is pretty. He gives her a monologue about being driven by revenge and fearing what happens for him next, and she calls this a little victory and hugs him. I don't know. But that's where we leave it for the two of them.
God. Beerf.
Speaking of beerf, we also have an A-plot, but first, we have a message for Genevieve and Arif.
Julie and Greg want to congratulate their friends Genevieve and Arif on tying the knot. Aww. They write, quote, "The night after Genevieve and Arif's first date, Genevieve came over to Julie and Greg's place, and they watched the Lifetime movie debut of a piece of garbage called Fatal Flip."
Rather than being horrified that Genevieve was going to spend her Saturday night watching trash, Arif requested that she live text him the movie so he wouldn't miss anything important, like the contractor turned stalker getting his hand drilled through. It quickly became clear that these two were totally made for each other. Arif soon joined the gang's bad movie night crew, and we've all been laughing and wincing ever since.
I think we might need an invitation to this crew, because Arif sounds awesome. At AWT90210 on Twitter, guys, jump us in. Until then, since Lifetime Movies helped bring Genevieve and Arif together, here are the top five Lifetime / made-for-TV movies starring Bev Niners that they should definitely set the DVR for as they settle into marital bliss.
Number five, Unwed Father, starring Brian Austin Green as the titular dad and Nicole Sue Scanlon-Tom as his accidental baby mama. Kids, use protection.
Number four, Co-Ed Call Girl, featuring Tori Spelling as a, quote, bookish college student who signed up for an escort service by her roommate as a joke, then goes with it? Sure.
Whomst among us, honestly. Number three, An Unfinished Affair, in which Jenny Garth plays a seduced and abandoned student who gets her revenge on married ex-lover Tim Matheson by A, refusing to return his artwork, and B, boning his son, played by the Fetch, obviously.
Number two, Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye, directed by and co-starring Jason Priestley and Carrie Ariel McCrabb's Wurrer in, well, it's the made-for-TV / Hollywood executive version of Pacific Heights. Because when you can't afford Michael Keaton, you get Holt McElhaney?
You sure do. At number one, last but certainly not least, Friends Till the End, starring Shando as the lead, quote, singer, unquote, of, as our correspondent put it, the 90s-est band of all time, who's stalked by Melissa, the girl in the wheelchair from Saved by the Bell and totally not saved by Pink from Dazed and Confused.
A.K.A. The Other London. From Julie and Greg, the Lifetime Movies app, and all of us hear it again with this. Mazel tov,
Genevieve and Arif. I'm so happy this message got to be in the episode titled, I'm Married. Saying to everyone you meet, just non sequitur, what's your order at Starbucks? I'm married. Anyway, on to the A-plot. Matt's got his own Bertha Mason. How you like that literary reference, Sarah? I have an English degree.
Reader, I love it.
Thank you so much. Nice. Matt's
a reader, I married it.
Reader, I'm married it. Wait, isn't that from Percy? I thought that was a Jane Austen one. I can't remember.
Could be.
Doesn't matter. Matt's
you have
in
a
New
higher
York.
Literary degree than I do. I will defer to you.
That's true, and don't you ever forget it.
I don't.
Matt is in New York. This is what I'm putting it to use to. Matt is in New York at a restaurant with Lauren, the broad who called him sweetheart last week. Apparently it's been a while since they saw each other because she can't believe he's a lawyer, even though it's what he always said he wanted to be. And he apologizes for taking her to kind of a down marketplace. It looks perfectly fine, but accuse her to exposit for us what she's been doing while Matt was busy becoming a lawyer in clip 7.
I've spent the last 3 years in an institution telling anybody who'd listen to me that a swarm of killer bees was going to assassinate the president. This is amazing, Matt.
Last fall, when Dr. Casas told me about clozapine and how it worked wonders on some of his patients.
Schizophrenics? Ugly word. Ugly disease.
I didn't know what to do. I tried not getting my hopes up, and that is why I wasn't there.
I woke up. That's the only way to describe it. I mean, it's like I can see everything clearly now. Everything's come into focus.
I should have been there.
You know, had a life. I didn't. But now I'm looking forward to going to L.A. with you and putting all this behind us.
Now about that, L.A., shouldn't you be near doctors?
No. They found a referral for me.
Really?
Oh. I'm sorry. I just assumed that you would want me...
In L.A. I do, of course.
No, if you don't, that's fine.
But I do.
That's okay. Good. Because that's where I want to be.
I don't know where to begin with this storyline.
I don't either.
Like, first of all, they're acting like whatever this drug is. I didn't look it up to see if it's real, but she's making it sound like it's L-Dopa or something. Like this is Awakenings.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I'm not a doctor either, but I don't feel like this is how... I feel like the drugs that are effective for this disease tend to be pretty brutal on the side effects front. And it's not just like this flowers for Lorinon thing where like, bink, I'm back. And also she wouldn't be. And I'm really not clear on the timeline of like, she's been institutionalized for 3 years.
Yeah.
Which sounds very dated to me. Like, I just don't think that's how psychiatric admissions worked as of even the 70s, never mind the 90s.
Right.
They would have figured out some medication that worked for her on a much shorter timeline, I feel. But again, I'm not a doctor and I don't know shit.
Right.
Here's what I do know. Mm-hmm. Hamilton College does not have a law degree.
Yeah.
If they got married when they were 18 or 19... I think he says 20, and then he got a degree. He got like a pre-law type degree from Hamilton, but then he would have had to go to law school.
Which is 3 more years, I believe, right?
Yeah, usually. And then pass the bar in California.
Yeah.
When he went to, like, where'd he go to law school? New York?
Right.
I mean, not that nobody ever does that. I'm just saying that's a little weird, and also don't. Like, wouldn't, but how, why
well, here's the
are
other
you
thing.
Married still? And
yeah, that's the other thing, because they try to be all cute with the storyline. Like, they wait until literally the last line of the episode for Matt to say that the relationship between the two of them is that they are married, even though the episode is called I'm Married. So dumb. But on top of that, like, if his whole thing is like, he's just been waiting for her to, you know, be able to live outside of the hospital again and be his wife in the way that, you know, she was before she was institutionalized. Why did he move to literally across the country? Like, why didn't he just stay in New York and be a doctor near her and continue seeing her? Because it's like, we have seen zero evidence that she was in his life until she picked up the phone and called him.
And how long has she been calling him?
Right.
Because I got the sense from the conversation we saw at the end of the last episode that this was not the first time that they had spoken.
Right.
It was just the first time that she, like, wasn't talking about killer bees or whatever. Like, everything about this is so... Like, if you're going to do this, like, this is a classic soap trope.
Of course.
Secret spouse. Fine.
Yes.
But I do kind of feel like, just make her your ex-wife and make the character 27, and this solves so many problems. But, like, don't give us... Like, they show his diploma.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bachelor's.
Yeah, but it says law school on top.
Yeah. Like, nice calligraphy course you took there, Brittany, but...
Yeah.
I actually Googled
this.
I'm so
ashamed. I just don't know why, like... I don't know why they, like, it's only for this, for story expediency purposes that someone in this real situation, like, either you're committed to your marriage, in which case you stay by your wife's hospital, or else you've decided you're effectively not married, which is how he's been acting, viz. Fucking Kelly.
Yeah.
And you get your marriage, you know, annulled, or you get divorced. And neither of these things has happened, even though he's a lawyer, like, and presumably know how.
And there were absolutely 100 opportunities for them not to provide details that are in active conflict with each other at every step of this, like, along every axis of the story. They just picked the thing that was, like, a provable lie. They're like, Trump, I don't understand.
Right.
Like, just say something vague and move on to something else that we can't check. No.
So let's get through it. So Matt comes to find Kelly at the store. When she asks about where he was when she tried to call him the night before, he elaborately lies about unplugging the phone and getting lost in a deposition and almost missing his plane.
Too much she detail.
She says he works way too hard, but he'll be able to unwind this weekend because she went ahead and booked them at that hotel in Santa Barbara after all. And when he starts to protest, she tells him it's all on her, but he says it's not that, it's work. And she kind of squints suspiciously and tells him to let her know by that night so she can cancel the reservation if she needs to. And he books it out of there before she can ask any more questions. Hey, I have an idea, Kelly. Why don't you just go with Donna? Like, what, instead of waiting around for him to disappoint you, as, spoiler alert, he's about to. Like, you can still take that weekend. Who gives a shit?
Yeah. Also, you don't like him. Everything he does pisses you off.
It's true.
Also, if you guys are dating and you missed each other that much, how come you're acting like the vibe between them is very weird? Mm-hmm. It's like neighbors whose spouses are actually fighting.
Yeah.
And then kiss or even hug. It's odd.
Yeah. He's doing his best, I think, but she just is like negative chemistry with him.
Yeah.
It's clear which one of them has been on the show since the beginning and which one of them is hoping he doesn't get fired before the end of the season. Just saying. So then Lauren is surprising Matt at his office and saying she was happy to walk from her hotel. And there's some dumb East Coast, West Coast banter about whether it's weird to walk places in L.A., but West Hollywood is pretty walkable. Whatever. She can't believe he moved to L.A. He claims he wasn't running away from her. Mm-hmm. She says she knows and probably would have done the same thing. She's impressed by his spurious law school diploma, which you can see the mess it is in the visual aids.
It's so bad. Even the frame is bogue.
It's real jank. And he brags that he finished 15th in his class. She's happy he's doing what he wanted.
17.
15th in his class of zero because Hamilton College doesn't have a law school. Anyway, he segues to bringing up the girl he's seeing. Lauren asks if he loves her. He says it doesn't matter. It matters to Lauren, but he says he's just happy Lauren's there. I don't know what that means. This is the other part of the storyline. Like, he's being how vague he's being with her is not helpful to her.
Well, and what exactly is she, like, what other life is she returning to?
Yeah. What,
like, there's, I feel, absolutely no way that her doctors would be like, sure, we'll call the Schizophrenia Institute of Los Angeles and get you someone out there. Like, it's not a fucking spa. Like, is she going to
schizophrenia?
Where is she going to live if they don't live together? Like, it's right. Like they're dating, but then it's also like they're just going to be married again.
Yeah, right.
And no one thought any of this through. And you know what's not great? Like, they're really acting like she was in solitary confinement for 25 years, not 3. And yet,
that comes up more
it'll
in
all
the
work
next
itself
episode,
out. Though. Just move into the Walsh house.
Okay? Right. So Kelly tries to call Matt at his office, but gets his machine and scowls, which, of course, you can see in the visual aids. And he's not there because he's walking Lauren back to her hotel room at the Bellage. Where else? He mildly teases her for running 2 red lights. In what car? She walked to his office and she says she saw them but couldn't process what they meant. And he's like, what? And she changes the subject by saying maybe she just wanted to get back to her room faster and then kissing on him. And he hugs her and gives her 2 basically closed mouth kisses, which is not really over the line, but also not exactly appropriate if he and Kelly are supposed to be exclusive either. You can see these kisses and judge what side of the line you feel they fall on, because I gift it for the visual. But then Lauren takes both his hands and tries to lead him to the bed, and he resists it. She says she just wanted him to hold her. And the conversation that ensues does not really clarify where they are in their relationship in clip 8.
If I had wanted more, would that have been so bad?
I want us to take our time.
Because of her?
Because I want us to do this right.
You checked me into a hotel.
I told you.
I feel like you're hiding me.
I have roommates. They have girlfriends at the zoo. Besides, I want us to be alone.
That's it.
I promise.
Sorry.
See? Now this is nice.
You have no idea.
They're sitting on a spermy bedspread in the hotel, by the way. was completely distracted by that the entire time. I was like, please strip off the comforter, please.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I like, she's basically saying, like, where are we? And he is not giving her anything. Like, he is, it's just not realistic that he wouldn't have thought this moment would come and make preparations for it.
Yeah, or that given everything we've seen of him, that he wouldn't have just told Kelly this.
Right.
Except the writers didn't know that it existed to tell.
Right.
So then he ends up being a complete shitbird to Kelly, which is the only thing that I enjoy about the storyline.
Yeah.
And which I is, enjoy it is, a lot.
Yes, but that's, but again, it's like Dylan with the racist, you know, community service boss. Like, you can't totally enjoy it because Matt did really fuck her over.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're spoiling so much. So as Matt and Lauren we? End in a yeah, as Matt and Lauren end in a hug, Kelly dials Matt again, and he's still not there. By the way, she's in her pajamas and sitting on her bed and has on so much makeup, like so much. But when she gets his answering machine, she gets out a card, calls the hotel in Santa Barbara, and cancels her reservation again. Just go without him, stupid. Matt finds Kelly in the store the next day and asks to talk. And obviously, she can tell something's up with him and asked if something happened in New York, because that was when things started to get awkward with him, which, no, they've been awkward all along, as we've been saying. He denies it unconvincingly, and she testily says that when she didn't hear from him, she canceled the reservation in Santa Barbara, and he says he thinks that was a good idea. She's pissy that he doesn't seem more down about it, I guess, and he says something has come up. She tries to get rid of him before finding out what it is, but says they can meet at the club after work. Just a great place to talk. The club. So David and Gina are out at a market of some kind when Gina spots Matt getting schmoopy with Lauren. And of course, Gina is delighted, but David has to be loyal to Kelly. And Matt and Lauren walk around holding hands, wearing balloon hats. Do you want to talk about that since you clipped this for the visual aids?
No. I never want to talk about that again. My caption was, why is this happening to us?
So they're generally acting like a couple, a very annoying one, as we hear in clip 9.
I get the feeling that people are staring at us.
I can't imagine why.
Yeah, maybe they think we're crazy.
Yeah, maybe.
We're not, though, are we?
Lauren,
don't. No, not me. I mean, us, for, you know, being together and trying to make this work after all stuff we've been through.
No, we're not crazy.
Because if this isn't going to work, I mean, if you have any doubts at all, I'm not sure I even want to try.
You know, at first, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but at first, I envied you. Not being able to understand how awful it felt being apart. You can't imagine ever getting over the sadness.
Until you do.
No, you don't. But it dulls. I didn't plan on meeting anyone else. You gotta believe that.
What's her name?
Kelly.
Okay, listen. I've already ruined your life once.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did. And I have no intention of ruining it again, okay? So if you are happy with the way your life is, I want you to live it.
I mean, our objections are already in the record, so.
Yeah, but also, like, the new shitty thing that comes out in this conversation is him being like, I envied you being not in your right mind because you couldn't understand what was happening to me.
Yeah, but then I eventually got over it and boned someone with a cat butt mouth.
Yeah, at least one per. I mean, who knows who else he fucked before he met Kelly, honestly.
Well, and I think he was maybe sort of trying to fuck Donna before he figured out that Noah was a thing, so.
Completely. Absolutely, he was.
Writers!
All right, moving on. So Gina goes to the store to find Kelly and complain about Dylan's supermodel and NA sponsor, but really to lead Kelly into this, clip 10.
You know, if, let's say, Matt was hanging out with someone who you hardly knew, how would you feel about it?
I would trust him.
Really? Well, just because you guys have had this big moment where you're sure everything's going to work out?
Exactly.
Well, I mean, you just got through saying that once you let your guard down, if you get a little vulnerable, that...
Gina.
Yeah?
Do you have something you want to say to me?
No, kind of.
Then say it.
Okay. see, I'm probably making more out of this than it is. It's just that I think maybe Matt might be seeing someone else.
The only thing I hate about that is that it takes her so long to get to it. Like, spit it out. This is why you ran over here from the beach or wherever you were, the market.
Oh, my God. The glee on her face. It was really quite amazing.
Yeah. Matt finds Kelly on the deck at her place since I guess she blew him off at the club. And she confronts him about what she heard from Gina without actually saying what she heard. But he's not an idiot and just asks her to let him explain. But she refuses and says they're over and leaves before he can get past saying that Lauren's not his girlfriend. Just a reminder, this episode is titled I'm Married. So then Kelly finds Matt at his office the next night. She doesn't really want to break up because of everything they have in common. And he agrees that what they had was great. Uh-oh, clip 11.
That's the part I don't understand, Matt. If what we had was so good, then why end it? Is what you have with what's her name that incredible?
Her name is Lauren. Lauren, this is Kelly. Kelly, this is Lauren. She's my wife.
I am shocked.
And that's the episode.
Yeah.
Yay.
That's it. All right. more to come in the next episode, but let's wrap this one up by naming our MVP. The rat. Hit its mark, did what it was supposed to do. Rat is the real pro of this whole mess.
Carol stood David up and then left. Saved herself. Good job, Carol.
All right, least valuable player. Matt, for being really irresponsible with a lot of people's feelings.
Yeah, and just indecisive and, like, just get on with it. Like, make decisions. Make any decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. All right, now for the Kim challenge.
Bad, bad, and dangerous to me.
Five ways from this episode, Dylan proves he is mad, bad, and dangerous to know. He punched his boss without thinking through the consequences for himself and others that he cared about, which is bad.
He's probably going to litter with that apple core, which is bad.
He continued digging at a cliff face after being told it was going to cause a rock slide, so that's dangerous.
Not to mention that his stick insect body will do nothing to break the, like, flow of the rock. It'll just run right over him and hit everyone else without even slowing it down, so that's pretty dangerous and bad.
True, and he chose an NA sponsor who was of the opposite sex, which is bad. It's not what you're supposed to do.
And yeah, and dangerous. And that's why
indeed.
It's bad.
Indeed.
And now, an excerpt from Luke Perry, Teen Heartthrob. I am not sure exactly where we left off, so if I reread a paragraph, I hope you will forgive me. I believe we left off with the behind-the-scenes people whom Luke is quick to point out make a big difference in the job. The writers are a behind-the-scenes group Luke admires. The 90210 writers have shown many different sides of his character, Luke said, and no one believed him. They have changed Dylan since his first episode and made him more vulnerable. He still keeps up a cool front, though. Dylan isn't ready for his friends to see every side of him. When Luke thinks there is a problem, he sometimes talks about it with Chuck Rosen, the executive producer. Luke describes what he thinks should happen. Chuck usually counters with another idea. Okay, ambassador.
The other idea is get the fuck out of my office, Luke Perry.
Fucking actors, am I right? Together, they reach compromises, i.e., don't make me call your agent. Although Luke doesn't always get his way, Reed, he never does, he's glad the producers and writers listen to him. They don't. According to Luke, the whole 90210 cast is fun. All the cast members, he added, work hard. When the show became more popular, the cast could hardly believe it. Seriously. Their success made them work harder to create an even better show. Working every day with the same people can get hard sometimes. Quote, there are some days that people don't get along as well as others, admitted Luke. But the bad moods never seem to last for long. It's not always easy, added Luke, but I wouldn't trade these guys for anything. On the set, Luke's good friends include Jason Priestley and Ian Ziering. All three live away from their families. Jason is from Vancouver, Canada.
Heard of it.
And Ian is from New Jersey.
No kidding.
The three actors turn to each other for support. Just as in his soap opera days, Luke continues to meet his fans. Since 90210, he has traveled around the country on promotional tours. Here is a picture of Jason Priestley looking super punchable, Shando, and Luke Perry at an event, and it is captioned Luke Perry's close friends Jason Priestley, spelled wrong in the caption, sure, and Shannon, spelled wrong in the caption, Doherty. Yeah. Also, nobody was close friends with Shando, but cool.
Yeah. Brilliant.
He rarely turns down interviews. He poses for pictures and appears on talk shows as required by his contract. Between rehearsals and interviews, Luke strives to improve himself as an actor. Tell us more. I have to be critical of my performance, he said. It's the only way I can improve. So far, he's proud of the work he has done, and he's happy with the series. Other shows about teenagers are either too preachy or put on a candy-coated view of life, he said. Insensibly. Beverly Hills 90210 isn't preachy, and we're certainly not candy-coated.
Oh, come on.
Come on, Blanche. And here endeth the excerpt from Luke Perry, Teen Heartthrob.
Amazing.
Next time on Again With This, yet another Valentine-isode takes its toll on your hosts as David borrows Donna for a work event, Steve suffers a skin cancer scare, Gina stirs the pot, and Kelly mourns the death of a relationship she seemed to actively despise. You'll actively despise our visual aids, which you can find for this and every other episode of Again With This on our website at previously.tv. Follow that website on Twitter at previously.tv and follow this podcast on Twitter at AWT90210. I'm conscientious prank objector Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is meaningful rock slide Tara Ariano, and she is on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is spiteful foreman David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
Hi, you know what to do after the beeperoni.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.